Hey, everybody, welcome back to Opera Now, baby. This is your host, Michael Rice. That's right, baby, I'm back. Nah. Giving you...
Oh, I'm dying. That's terrible. No more Wolfman Jack. Oh, excuse me.
Giving you all the news, baby, in the opera world.
Yeah, we've been gone for a while. But, you know, funk that. We're back. I'm here to pledge to you, we're doing a new show every week. Tuesday is our show day. Go to your iTunes, go to the Googles, go to the webpage, operanow.blogspot.com, Opera Now in the iTunes store, and download the show there. Every Tuesday, we're going to have a show up. I guarantee it. I swear to you. I'm reaffirming. It's like the Promise Keepers. I'm reaffirming my love for you, my audience. Had a lot of great comments from people, so... let's go ahead and start the show up. All right, enough of my yakking, as Marty DeBurgi says in Spinal Tap. We've got two people on, and I know I said before that a three-person show is death, but we're missing Ethan. He's MIA, but we do have our good friends Brian McGilvray.
Hello,
and of course Oliver Camacho.
Hi,
welcome back, gentlemen. Thank you for coming back to our Opera Now. Dot, you know, 2.0, because it's a new show. It's a totally new show now, I've decided.
It is.
I wasn't briefed on that.
It's all right. I'm changing it all up. Actually, not really, but I'll just
follow along.
I'm just happy that we're back. Okay, a lot of stuff has gone on over the last couple weeks, but let's do a couple stories, and then we'll try to do some cleanup afterwards. Here's one that I liked. We'll start with mine, and then everybody's got their own little pet peeve or story today. From blogs.guardian.co.uk, do musicals deserve opera stars? This is jumping from a story early in the month about Bryn Terrell playing Sweeney Todd in London. She wasn't convinced by the idea, but he proved to be a cut above most of the cast.
Shocked.
This is a production they did of Sweeney Todd. It was kind of a mix of opera star, well, at least one opera star, Bryn Terrell, of course, playing Sweeney Todd, and the rest were all musical theater stars. People like Philip Quast, who has done a lot of stuff in the West End, most notably to people he was on the world ultimate or symphonic recording of Les Miserables. And he was actually very good. He played Javert in that. It also featured Emma Williams, who is a quasi-friend of Opera Now. So, of course, she's often on Musical Talk with my man Nick Hudson. But they put Bryn in there, and this reviewer said that, she wondered if it was going to be good, but, you know, he did a pretty good damn good job. And so
turns out he could sing and act.
Exactly. She approached Bryn Terrell and Sweeney Todd with extreme skepticism and suspicion. But I was wrong. Not only can Bryn Terrell sing Sondheim as well as he sings Wagner, but he also makes the rest of the cast at this semi-stage short run look embarrassingly inept. Wow.
Did she say what her fears were based on, precisely?
She did not. I mean, I assume it's just part of an opera singer coming into musical theater. The whole idea of crossover. Not many people have been able to do it very well. This looks pretty interesting.
Well, early in her article, she mentions a fear of seeing Eminem in Oklahoma. So, I mean, if that's her idea of crossover, then
she's being pretty extreme there. I don't think there's any fear of that in the near future. But how about this? An opera singer coming in, kicking ass, taking names.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she kind of sounds like somebody who gets a lot of surprises in life. Frankly, I don't know. I mean, to me, it would be kind of a no-brainer to get Bryn Terrell in.
Yeah, but if somebody who writes for the theater or attends the theater mainly may have kind of a preconceived notion of the ability of somebody who is, you know, has a great fame as an operatic singer to come over to music theater and learn them, but here he did it.
Well, let's talk about that. What specifically, I mean, I know it sort of is assumed by many people, but what specifically is the rap against opera singers, or what skills are required in music theater that opera singers somehow elude them?
Well, that's an age-old question. I don't know if we can answer it.
I'm asking you to.
In one podcast.
I would ask that you answer it now.
My initial thought is that singers are... It is so often just about training your voice.
So it's the whole stand and sing, be wooden.
I guess, or maybe even just the difficulty that it takes to sing opera requires maybe more dedication and more training on the side of the vocal mechanism as opposed to every other aspect of the theatrical side. So,
okay. So at best, that's a really outdated notion, I think. I mean, given what is generally expected of opera singers, in this day and age.
But this is somebody maybe who doesn't have as much familiarity.
Who lives under a rock.
Yes.
I mean, who is she that she has a blog writing about theater and performing arts, and she has not but heard of, you know, Bryn Terfel before and knows that he's had success all over the continent, you know, our continent, you know, doing this role. So
the guy's huge.
He literally is huge. There's some picture. I saw some pictures of him.
He's got a big head.
It's huge. And one of the cast members is on the Opera Now Facebook page, and there's a picture of her with him, and his head is gigantic. Mm-hmm. It has three moons. they may discover a fourth at any moment. It's gigantic. It's amazing. But here he is with that big head, not only not falling over, but showing them how to act. Sounds good. No offense to them, but at least it's good to see somebody coming in and showing.
Well, I mean, it's really nice to hear that he made everybody else look bad.
I guess, yeah.
No, I find that.
Not as much that they look bad, but that he held his own, and in holding his own, he kind of set the tone for everybody else.
Well, that's a charitable way of putting it,
I guess.
Well, I think if you get a real voice out there amongst a bunch of... you know, semi-voices, then, you know, it's instructive for people.
True. Maybe the voice is much a part of it. Maybe it carries it off.
It is, and it used to be, let's face it.
Maybe Bryn Terfel will be the next Phil Potts.
He could be. Mm-hmm. Paul Potts,
whatever.
Pol Pot, whatever his name was.
But seriously, I mean, nobody blinked at Ezio Pinza singing in South Pacific, so...
True.
What's the difference?
None, I guess.
Fundamentally. No. You are correct. There is no difference.
But that was certainly, even though as revolutionary as it may have been at the time, it was still...
It wasn't, though. No, it wasn't revolutionary.
Well, not revolutionary in the terms of the independence of America from Great Britain, but certainly different, not the norm at the time. And again, as we've said before, in some way, the kind of the aesthetics of both Broadway and opera were not as far removed, maybe, as they are today.
Right. That's true. So. But Sweeney Todd is a little more in the traditional... I mean, okay, I shouldn't say that. But
well, no, it is certainly... Many people consider it almost an opera, as opposed to... Even just at its basic level, at its structural form and the way it works.
It's not Miss Saigon.
No, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
So,
good for Bryn.
Yeah. Take that, you magnificent Welsh bastard. You did us right. Let's go on to... let's take Brian's story. The Adoption of Opera by Heather
Not
McDonald.
Literally my story, but...
At thecityjournal.org. Roll with it, Brian. Take it. Take us away.
Well, it's a long article.
According to Oliver. And myself, I agree.
It was too long for Oliver.
Is Oliver here still? Oh, there he is. Okay.
Yes, I'm
here. Okay.
About the director's theater in Europe, the tradition that has sort of come to the fore.
Regie theater?
Yeah, the German Regie Theater, however the heck you say it.
Which means, loosely termed, director's theater, meaning that the director and the production kind of dictates everything.
As it serves the notion that the director should have an elevated status vis-a-vis the composer and or librettist of the work in question, and therefore can override at will what were, you know, the more or less clear intentions of the composer And this is an article by Heather McDonald in the City Journal, which is a fine magazine.
Which city?
That would be this city.
No.
And she basically eviscerates, you know, the basic...
Wait, you've eviscerate, you've lost me already, Brian.
Should I use a three-syllable word?
Yes.
You sound like Heather McDonald.
Well, here's a good... This is a catchy opening paragraph. Mozart's lighthearted opera, The Abduction from the Seraglio, does not call for a prostitute's nipples to be sliced off and presented to the lead soprano, nor does it include masturbation, urination as foreplay, or forced oral sex. Europe's new breed of opera directors, however, know better than Mozart what an opera should contain. Not only does The Abduction at Berlin's Komische Oper feature the aforementioned activities, it also replaces Mozart's graceful ending with a Quentin Tarantino-esque bloodbath and the promise of future perversion.
So all of our listeners will be familiar with these notorious, infamous operas that get staged in places like Berlin and maybe even more so Munich, where, you know, there's mass nudity and orgies on stage in the middle of something like Handel's, you know, Xerxes or something. So
Jerxes, maybe?
Yeah.
Jerk-offsies.
Or, you know, and the what's almost become a cliche where Don Giovanni, you know, masturbates on stage or something, mm-hmm. apparently. So, and it's just a great article. People should read it at cityjournal.org.
If you have a half hour to spare.
Well, it's, you know, it's a few pages long, but yeah. It's worth reading.
Web pages.
And because I think she makes a great point. I think there's a sort of divide in the operatic world, and this is something that was, the you know, very much in play when we were coming through music school back in the day, that you couldn't stage, that it was sort of somehow, you know, cliche and kitschy to stage an opera in a traditional way, and in order for it to be at all taken seriously, it had to, you know, speak to modern audiences by being updated in this way and that. And I think this is a good answer to that, this article, in that, you know, first of all, how, you know, way too far that's been taken by some of these more arrogant and self-centered European directors, but also that the very notion itself is flawed, that these works can stand on their own and that they were conceived in a certain period, and it's insulting to audiences. I can read a good paragraph from the middle of it, which, if you'll let me, pretty much sums up the article. May I?
Please go ahead.
Okay. Nicholas Payne, former general director of the English National Opera and champion of Calixto Bieto, which is a director who is known for this kind of vulgarity and obscenity and
boorishness,
whatnot. Yes. He echoes this devaluing of the past. He says, director's theater, or whatever you want to call it, is an attempt to grab the material and make it speak to the spirit of today's times, isn't it? I'm not saying that the only way to do Poppea is to make Nero the son of the chief guy in North Korea. Nevertheless, if you're bothering to reproduce Poppea, it has to have some way of speaking to people now, unquote. And that's sort of almost accepted as conventional wisdom, I think, these days. And then the Heather McDonald, the writer of the article, goes on to say, it's hard to know whom that statement insults more, contemporary audiences or Monteverdi. Payne assumes that Monteverdi's works are so musically and dramatically limited that they cannot speak to us today on their own terms, and that audiences so lack imagination that they cannot find meaning in something not literally about them. And I wholeheartedly agree with that.
Well, she makes an interesting point talking about, early in the article, the Gelb at the Met, who's, you know, trying to attract new audiences by injecting, quote, theatrical excitement into the house, predicting what that would ultimately mean was difficult enough before another bombshell exploded this February at City Opera when, of course, the new... I'm blanking
Butterfly.
Out his name. I'm sorry. No. At City Opera, the new director.
Oh, director
Mortier. Coming over, who is one of the most prominent exponents, according to her, of Regia Theater as its next general manager. This time of critical transition is an opportune moment both to celebrate the Met's role in preserving a central glory of Western culture and to consider the great opera house's future. To see how much is at stake, one need only glance across the Atlantic and increasingly at other opera companies here in the U.S. So,
well, You know, can I say, I think that her tone in this article is really alarmist, and I don't like how she lumps together everybody who like has an idea that's different than the traditional staging as a, you know, reggae theater director, like Peter Sellers, for example. Like, I don't think Peter Sellers is doing, you know, so much damage, you know, to these operas. I think actually his famous Da Ponte trilogy was really enlightening, and he brought out some really beautiful moments in the score that were actually, you know, part of Mozart's music. But she lumps them together with, you know, whoever, you know, this Calixto person, you know, and all this masturbating and nipple slicing. It's like, it's not the same thing. And I think she's making it sound like, you know, Gerard Mortier is going to turn New York City Opera into whatever, into Munich. And I don't think that's going to happen. And from what we've talked about in earlier podcasts, that, you know, he understands, you know, the American audience. He knows, you know, that it can't be reggae theater, you know. So I don't know. I think she's a little bit long-winded, especially, but I think she's also a little bit extreme in her criticism.
Yeah, I mean, well, Peter Sellers is kind of a love him or hate him guy, and she clearly hates him and very much disagrees with, you know, his decisions. And I think that's valid, you know. I mean, I think it can be argued either way with him, but the point, the more central point is that is this idea, or the more central point of contention is this idea that directors, you know, what is their role, or how far do they have any business pushing their role onto the you know, the intentions of the composer? Mm-hmm. And when it directly contradicts what's in the score and in the libretto, what's happening on stage, then I think, you know, you're basically doing a disservice to the work of art.
Well, I think the biggest reason for a lot of this, I think, is that this stuff is all public domain, and they're not able to take, you know, in theater, they're not able to take Death of a Salesman and totally restructure it.
Mm-hmm.
They're not able to take South Pacific and, you know, North Pacific, you know what I mean? This stuff is all open, it's fodder for anybody's ideas. And sometimes maybe the ideas are interesting, but the main reason is that they can do whatever the hell they want with them because they don't have to worry about paying anybody to do it. They can do whatever they want because it's all out there in the open.
Well, that, and they're also state in Europe or in Germany, they're state funded.
True. Yes. Those two factors are huge. Especially the state funding is a big part of it.
Yeah, because it means they're not relying on the audience to accept it. I mean, they can do whatever they want, and the theater can be empty.
Well, I think an interesting question is what are the reactions from? We've got this woman talking about it here, but what do people think about it there?
They hate it. Well, the singers hate it almost universally.
Yes, that's true.
And the conductors too, and they feel like they can't speak out because it's such a common thing, and they don't want to, you know,
rock the boat.
Well, they don't want to reduce their marketability as singers or be seen as obstructionist. And so that's a problem. And it's sort of this relationship between these self-regarding, you know, directors and the people in the government who fund, you know, the theaters, and the public, I think it's generally pretty unpopular with the public. You know, I think they stay away in droves for the most part from the more notorious. I mean, she mentioned about this seraglio, this abduction that this guy directed, which the title of the article is taken from.
Mm-hmm.
That the audience was shouting, you know, at the stage, you know, like, this isn't what Mozart intended. So I don't know how many in the audience were, but if I could read one more little passage that speaks to what you just brought up. She says, "The dirty little secret of Rigi Theater is this: its practitioners know that no one will bother to show up for their drearily conventional political cant unless they ride parasitically on the backs of geniuses. Bieto has said that his purpose in staging the abduction was to highlight abuses in the contemporary sex trade. Let's pretend for a moment, let's pretend for a moment that Bieto actually cares about the fate of sex workers. His path is clear: keep his grubby mitts off Mozart and write his own damn opera. But without Mozart or Verdi, the Reggae Theater director is nothing. He cannot even hope for third-rate avant-garde status. In a world where displaying bodily fluids in jars, performing sex acts in public, etc., will land you a gig at the Venice Biennale and a government grant, the only source of outrage still available to the would-be scourge of propriety is to desecrate great works of art." So, in other words, if they didn't have Mozart to piss on, they'd
or
be
to,
nobody.
Or to piggyback on.
Right.
bareback, we'd like to say.
Yeah, in the sex trade work.
Yes.
But, I mean, Oliver, you make a good point that it's probably not fair to lump everybody into that, every controversial director into that particular category.
And you know what? Like, New York City Opera still relies on having butts in seats, you know, to make a business out of it. So I seriously doubt Jared Moriarty is stupid enough to...
Until there are more butts on stage, I guess. We'll worry about that.
Right.
Bareback or otherwise.
Yes.
But it is interesting what gets passed off as normal, I think, these days, you know, to have these sorts of bizarre, you know, disconnects between the music and what's on stage and, you know.
Well, you know, I'm of two minds about it because I actually, you know, got lured into opera by watching the Don Giovanni, the Peter Sellers Don Giovanni. I mean, I was probably a freshman in high school when I saw that. And I thought it was really cool, you know. And, of course, now I can sit through a regular Don Giovanni and understand how it relates to me or to, you know, to current society or whatever. But back then when I was young, you know, I needed those cues, you know, to help me relate it. And so, and look at me now. I'm, you know, I'm one of the most important people in the opera community. So.
It's true. Certainly in the opera podcasting community. Well, who knows where this will lead. This is, I mean... I think the biggest part of this, I mean, some of it maybe is insensibility because, you know, of course, we talk about the differences. People talk about how cosmopolitan, you know, Europe, they can do whatever they want and how we're, but, you know, Europe's a lot older than we are. And it's just, we've only been around, you know, whatever it is, 225, 250. So it is in a way like comparing apples and oranges, I think, the two cultures. That's part of it. Part of it is also the government funding because they don't have to worry about getting people in the seats necessarily.
No, and I think as long as that's the case here, then
you're not going to see it. To
you're
that,
not gonna
certainly
have this
not to
tidal
that degree.
Wave of,
no.
But still, it's a good article for because I mean a lot of American singers have to go work in Europe.
I mean, somebody like Christopher Alden is probably the biggest exponent of something like this in this country, and he is certainly by new. As strange as a lot of his stuff is, and I've been in one of his things, and I didn't understand it really. It's certainly not to the same degree that, you know, no nipples were harmed in the production of Imeneo that I took part in. So,
well, they were fake nipples, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But there is this trickle down effect, you know, where
voodoo economics.
People see that sort of thing happening in Europe, maybe, and then they feel like they have to do something innovative. And more often than not, it probably misfires.
Yeah, it does. It's different. You don't have to worry about it. It's apples and oranges. We're different. We're not Europe. We're different. We've got a totally different sensibility. You don't have to be. There's plenty of people who. You can certainly get. The issues are different in this country. The social issues are different. You know, you can speak to somebody and maybe do some type of different interpretation of an artistic work that doesn't have to be the same way that they would do it in Europe. Because it's a different world. It's a totally different world. Much more different, I think, than people are willing to admit.
You know, they have McDonald's over there, Michael.
They do. But the McDonald's comes from America.
No, it's different McDonald's.
Yeah.
You've got different food.
You know what they call a quarter pounder with cheese in France? Royale with cheese. You know why? The metric system.
They're in the metric system.
Yeah.
That's right. You know what they use? You know what they use on French fries? Instead of ketchup in Denmark, in Holland,
I believe
mayonnaise. They drown the shit, motherfuckers, in that shit, man.
Okay.
I know, baby, you dig it the most. So anyway, let's move on to another Monteverdi story. Oliver, the full Monteverdi. I like it. New York Times, take it away.
This is a story that I flagged for our delicious bookmark. This is a group... based out of Britain, I guess. They're
Wait a minute. Let me see their name. Is this why you like them so much?
A Fagolini?
Faglioni? No,
they're I Fagiolini. And they're,
the beans?
Which is Italian for
the beans.
The faggots.
No, it's the beans. They got beans in them. Yeah. That's why.
The little beans.
They're full of beans.
Well, they are apparently a troupe of singers. I think it's a dozen of them that remind me of me.
When you were young.
Yes. They have staged or have they put on a concert, I guess, of Monteverdi Madrigals, the fourth book of Madrigals.
Truly, really his best work. of the books.
his best opera, yeah, or his madrigals. Cool. And I use opera in the Italian
sense. The sense of work.
Works, yes.
And they have it so that the audience comes to the theater, and the theater has been redesigned as a restaurant, and audience members are set at tables of four.
Not a brothel.
And they have to like wait for like half an hour before the show starts, and meanwhile they sip wine and they eat cheese, and then suddenly, kind of organically, the performance begins, and they didn't realize that they were actually sitting amongst I Fagiolini, who begin to stand up at the table.
So they're in the audience as well.
Yeah,
spread around in tables.
Right, and they perform these madrigals, which are basically love songs and laments and whatnot. And there's a lot of duets in these things. And, it becomes kind of like, dinner theater,
Mm-hmm.
And, there's not like a narrative arc here, but I do think that this music is very dramatic. And this is the kind of music that, I really love. And I think deserves to be staged and can really appeal to new audiences, because the dramatic arcs are very short and kind of like little videos, this is what our audience I think needs, especially our generation of audience. They need little bites of music that they can digest and then, move on.
And put onto their cell phone.
Well, no, yeah. I mean, just take and
just kidding.
YouTube it. And come on, Brian, let him speak.
Yeah.
We listen to your long diatribe about...
So I really applaud this effort, and I'm actually a little bit envious that they thought of it before me, because it sounds totally like
this time they thought about it before you, other than like Peter Gelb or all these other people who stole your thunder ahead of time, even though you had disagreed about it and thought about it before.
Yeah, no, but this is really an original idea, and I applaud it, and it really does. I mean, I don't know how many seats they fill there, but I can't imagine it was a gigantic
audience. Yeah,
it's
at the top of Juilliard. It's not a huge place, but it's a good-sized room.
But just to bring, intimacy to this music and to let the audience feel like they're in some way participating in it, I think that's what we need. I think, there's, how many seats does the Metropolitan Opera have? I don't know, like 2,000, 3,000 seats?
It's got like 3,000-something, close to 4,
yeah.
I think, yeah.
I mean... That is really difficult, I think, for an audience member sitting, in the back of standing room.
I mean, you can't see the nipples when they get sliced off.
Exactly.
When you're that far back.
I think it's hard for an audience member there to feel moved, unless the performance is superior or the staging is superior, But in a situation like this, I think it'd be very easy for that audience member, even if the performance isn't outstanding, to feel like, oh, wow, that was a very special evening. And isn't that what we want? Do we want people to go to the opera or go to a concert of singers and just feel like they had an event in their life, that they were touched, that they saw something unique, That to me is what we need to bring back to opera, is the feeling that the audience is carrying away something special. And the reason why I really I say this is because, I live in Chicago, where we have Lyric Opera of Chicago, and swarms of people go to Lyric Opera, and people pay so much money to be in the audience there, and people subscribe and blah, blah, blah. And then Lyric Opera has, the nerve to put on a show where they know that half their audience is going to probably walk out because... the production is so bad or the music is not appealing, I don't think any artistic organization in 2007 has the right to have such a loyal audience who are willing to pay so much money and know that their audience is probably going to be bored. I think that's unacceptable. So I really applaud something like this where they know that they're going to capture the audience, they're going to hold them in the palm of their hand, even if it's just for, 90 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Bravo, I Fagiolini.
Yes. You sweet little beans, you.
even if it is gay.
It's not. Shut up.
What's gay about it?
I'm kidding.
You're a homophobe.
I love it. You know I love Monteverdi.
You don't love Monteverdi the way I love Monteverdi.
That's true.
Oh, please.
Speaking of Monteverdi, did anybody listen to LA Opera yesterday on the radio? They broadcast the Popea from LA Opera with Susan Graham and Kurt Streit and all these like big name opera singers.
Is that the one that was they did? That was the one they did at Lyric, though, wasn't it?
No, it's the LA Opera production.
But I think it's the same production, though, like the Stark Black production.
Lyric hasn't had Popea, I don't think, ever.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't realize they had never done it there.
It's not the right space for that.
Yeah.
But anyway. It wasn't horrible. I was actually listening to it expecting to really hate it, but they did an okay job, you know, making it a little bit larger, like filling out the string section and whatever, but still respecting the intimacy. And they had some really good singers, like Nick Pond was on that, and he sounded really good at singing Lucrano, the singing teacher. Anyway, I don't know, I digress, but I was just delighted that Monteverdi is getting his time in the sun right now, his 15 minutes.
Yeah, that's true. It's his 400th anniversary, that's why.
Yeah.
I think he's one of those perennially modern composers. And so he's always, I think he always stays fresh, you know.
Part of me wonders, though, in this era of, as we've talked about, kind of director-driven productions, will stuff like Monteverdi and those pieces become fodder for reinterpretation more so than something like Puccini or Verdi? Is it to, in their minds, maybe like bare enough and stark enough to need some like pep and need some kind of new interpretation? That's a possibility and a fear, I think.
I'm sure it's been done with the staging and all.
Yeah,
I mean,
but will it only get worse, though? That's what I wonder.
Maybe.
Chicago, a couple years ago, Chicago Opera Theater did Popea, and they had it kind of like where Nero was Bill Clinton and Popea was Monica Lewinsky, and it kind of worked, actually. I didn't dislike it, actually. I think the audience really got into it. And
see, I'm allergic to that shit, but whatever. If it gets people into Monteverdi, fine.
They had Jane Glover conducting. You can't beat that.
That's true.
No, I mean, the 1610 Vespers are one of my Desert Island pieces.
I prefer the 1812 Overture, if we're going to talk about years.
We're going to have our own Monteverdi podcast, yeah. Brian.
Or 1984, but that's another story. Let's move on ahead to, we're going to follow up on some, once, as I told you in the last episode, however long ago that was, I don't even remember, we're going to try to follow up on stories, just like my man Bill O'Reilly does, you know, keeping you abreast and keeping you in touch. We talked about an opera that was going to be a film that was going to be doing called Repo, the Genetic Opera. Apparently, we've got new news. Ex-con Paris Hilton has been cast in the movie alongside my man, Paul Sorvino, the great friend of opera. She's going to be playing the daughter of Paul Sorvino. Once again, Repo, the Genetic Opera, it's a rock opera. It's less Wolfgang Mozart than Chainsaw Massacre. About this future where, you know, organs and death come at a premium, blah, 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 and your best chance of surviving is being able to afford an organ transplant.
She's not going to sing, though, is she?
I don't know. I think so.
It says she'll sing.
Yeah, she's got an album out there, so.
Well, I forgot that.
Fresh from jail. She's able to turn jail around and make something of herself, getting a big-time opera movie. And here you got, you know, Lindsay Lohan. 11 days out of rehab, she's back arrested. So, and
just can't get a break.
I will go on record. Not that I want this to happen, but I said when this first Lindsay Lohan stuff happened, I predicted she wouldn't live throughout the year. And I wonder if that's going to happen now.
Michael.
Well, no, I fear it's going to happen. I certainly don't want it to happen. You know, she's got a big future in pornography, but. I'm afraid that it will happen, so. But anyway.
I won't cry if it does.
No, neither will I. Let's move on to some funny items, some ridiculous items of the day. Here's one little tongue-in-cheek bit. This is going out to, and I'm only doing this, and I know you're out listening to us, so. From Conrad High Jock to rising opera singer. Tanglewood, the next stop for former jazz trombonist Matt Wirth. Now, I know Matt. He's a friend of mine, and he is a big fan of the show. And he's from Hartford, and they had this little article about him in The Current. He's doing a like Guglielmo, I think, or something at Tanglewood with Levine. So this is just kind of like a local boy makes good, but it's pretty funny.
What an article. It's so long, and it's just...
It's almost as long as that other article. You hated so
he's
much.
He's basically workshopping Cozy with James Levine.
Well, no, they're doing it, the fellowship artists or whatever they're called.
It doesn't mean that like he's like the next Nathan.
I mean, who knows? I mean, he's got some guns. I know him. Oh, he's a good guy. It's just this story is, and I know he's listening and laughing,
Conrad High jock to rising opera singer.
I will say,
Matt Worth.
If anybody is not on their computers listening to this, you should take a look at this guy. He's very handsome.
He's so handsome. He's so tall. He's like 6'3".
He has got some great teeth in that mouth.
He really does. And it's my man Nick Renito taking that shot. The famous cut-rate New York headshot taker. He does good work. So kudos to you, Matt Worth, you SOB. Here's another big – this is a big story I saw that I wanted to share with everybody. This is at the Indiana Daily Student News. The newspaper at IU, which has a big, of course, Bloomington, big music school.
The newspaper of record
for IU, Indiana University students. IU opera student moves to New York.
Wow.
Rachel Lubbers can vividly recall she's leaving Indiana University to go to Manus for graduate school. Nothing
Secret
against her.
Of my success.
Nothing against Manus.
'Cause I'm living.
How many thousands of students have gone from Indiana University to move to New York? And why the hell is this an article in their newspaper?
Oh, she's singing at Tutto Bene, right?
Yeah, some
with two N's.
Is that it's some restaurant in Indiana in Bloomington, I guess?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I want anybody out there listening who knows Rachel Lubbers or Rachel Lubbers herself to please contact.
Yeah, please contact me to see if you were as confused as we were when they contacted you to do this. IU opera student moves to New York. What the?
Oh, boy.
Was it a slow day? Wasn't anybody poisoned at the student union? Did a outside porch not collapse under a keg and 55 undergraduates?
I think I found the part why they're writing this article.
Why?
So somebody says she has such a beautiful voice. That's probably what it is.
Yeah, I guess she may.
She sings happy birthday to the customers at the restaurant, supposedly.
Rachel, if you're out there or if somebody knows Rachel, this is nothing against you at all. I just don't understand why this would warrant an article in a newspaper of any kind, be it a college paper or the New York Post even. everybody in New York, watch out. An IU opera student is moving to New York.
25 hours a day.
That's awesome. I wonder if she's drive straight through. That's about 14 hours. That'd be great. Standing tall on the wings of my dreams. Oh, good stuff. I'm walking on air. Kudos to you, Rachel Lubbers. Who Lubbers? Who? I can't believe it. Okay, let's move on. We got to do it.
Don't, not yet.
Okay, Oliver, go.
I just wanted to
last
shout
minute
out,
edition.
I wanted to shout out to the people who were at Amherst Early Music Festival last month. We did La Callisto. And, you know, I didn't think that much of Cavalli as a composer, mainly because there's not really any good recorded documents of complete Cavalli operas. But I will say that La Callisto is a brilliant opera and that it needs to be done more. And I hope that that somebody out there is listening to me. You impresarios out there, you should stage La Callisto because it's an audience pleaser and the music is brilliant. And I just want to say here and now that I was lucky enough to hear Ian Howell and Catherine Dane and my arch nemesis in life, Michael Sansoni, who are all young, up-and-coming singers who can sing whatever they want to, be it Cavalli or, you know, Puccini. These are amazing singers that you're going to hear a lot of, what's his name? The rising jock from Courant.com.
Yeah,
what's
Matt Worth.
Matt Worth, yeah. They are the next Matt Worth. these were
Maddie, I know you're listening. USOB, I love it.
These are amazing, amazing singers who...
And Matt is, I will say, Matt's a great singer.
I'm sure he
is. It's just it was a poke at him, so yeah.
Yeah.
And so handsome and tall.
So that's what I wanted to leave with. La Callisto, good opera. Ian Howell, good countertenor. Catherine Dane, amazing soprano. And Michael Sansoni, the best coloratura tenor since Oliver Camacho.
Well, I know Glimmerglass was going to do Callisto about 2 years ago, but they canceled it and did Pirates of Penzance instead.
I think they Chicago Music of the Baroque State did a concert version of it.
Yeah, I know. They're not really Music of the Baroque. They're Music of the High Baroque or Music of the Early Classical Period.
Wow, okay, throwing down a glove again.
But I love Gene Glover. I love Gene Glover. Yeah,
so, well, anyway, let's do it. Guess who died? Oh, man. It's been like the St. Valentine's Day Massacre over the last month.
Where was the hook that you did?
I don't know. I got no hook in me left. This is a sad one. I mean, we'll start it out. Beverly Sills. We've talked about her before. And actually, I want to have everybody listen when the show's over at the end of the closing music. I'm going to add on a little interview I did with my parents, who actually had an encounter with Beverly Sills, a dinner, and another little thank you note that they received from her, which is pretty interesting. So she kind of shows what a genuinely real and kind person that she was. So we've lost Beverly Sills. We've talked about her, you know, many times, so we certainly don't need to justify what she's done. Regine Crespin also passed away.
Great fucking soprano.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wonderful. I saw her do a masterclass
at Northwestern. I was there. Yeah. I was there. It's awesome.
She was great. She had her, you know, her big multicolored blouse and her big scarf, totally old school.
And her perm hair. She was amazing. You could see her bald head underneath.
Oh, terrible. Yeah, great though. Wonderful singer. Again, we don't have to justify her. Teresa Stich Randall died as well.
I didn't hear about that one.
Yeah, it was recent. That was recently, within the last like week or two. And then, of course, I think one of the saddest things I've ever heard in my life, seriously, in any facet of the entertainment business, certainly, Jerry Hadley passed away, committing suicide.
Not even doing it successfully.
No,
at that.
I know.
It's a mess.
You know, this is a guy who was a big star in the 80s and 90s. And you know, you think you reach a point and you have it all, and it's all you need to do is push through to that level, and then you're going to be fine. But you know, some people think he had fallen on hard times, wasn't doing the kind of things he had used to do. Like in the past 7 or 8 years.
How old was he again?
Like 50, I think. 51, 52.
So he was born in 1952, it says.
Oh,
here,
he's
so.
Yeah, 55, 56. I used to see him. He used to live in Wilton, Connecticut, which is where I used to do theater in the summer, and I saw him a couple times walking around town. And he was also going to be the town of Wilton was celebrating their like centennial or sesquicentennial, and the town has a strong history, like artistic history, with GNS. They've had a lot of companies in that area, and they were going to do a anniversary production of Pinafore as part of the town's anniversary, and they had asked Jerry if he would do it, and he said he was very interested. He wasn't able to do it because of some conflict, but he seemed interested and wanted to do it, and I think he would have done it if he could have. That was just the kind of guy he was. He was about his community and everything. And, you know, hearing what happened to him, you know, it's amazing that somebody can, and this has been said to death, I'm sure, on blogs and bulletin boards, whatever, but you wish you could just, you know, he was a good singer. He did a lot of great stuff. He was great in Mozart. Great with crossover stuff as well. Had a big hit with Candide, and you know, it's hard.
His Rodolfo ain't so bad either, you know.
No, yeah, Bel Canto,
Leonard Bernstein, and Angelina Rio, and
well, that was Boheme.
Tom Hampson.
That was Boheme.
Oh, that's what I meant. Yeah.
You know, it's just to see somebody hit that level and not even know about it. People who knew him had no idea that it was happening. That he was hitting, he was doing that poorly, emotionally. It's terrible, and you wish you could, you know, go back and stop him on the street the day before and say, hey, you know, I really love what you do. I used to listen to, he was an inspiration to me because he was one of the first singers I heard when I started singing.
Yeah, he was like the great American hope.
He was.
Back in the
mid-80s. And to many degrees, in many ways, fulfilled that hope. Had a wonderful career, yeah.
Yeah.
You just wish you could, you know, stop him and say, hey, I really love what you're doing. And,
you know, maybe it would have made a difference, maybe it wouldn't, you know. It's something like depression is so dark and mysterious that it doesn't matter sometimes that you don't even know that you're feeling that way and you're not thinking rationally, so.
Can I say something as the estrogen of the show tonight? That I think what's important to learn from this is that as singers, we have to really take care of each other. And this is a business that, you know, where we, you know, kind of often stab each other in the back or talk.
And they'll chew you up and spit you out.
Yeah.
When Levine had his anniversary, it's amazing that people like, or when the Met Volpe had his anniversary, that people like Hadley weren't there on the stage. Because he was such a big part of Volpe's reign over the 80s and the 90s. I'll go down and say it. That was shameful. That they didn't have him there in some way. If they didn't think his voice was what it once was, that's fine. Have him there. Have him do a crossover piece, whatever, you know, if they're worried. And I'm sure he would have been fine, whatever he was doing. But that was pretty shameful. So, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Oliver. Oliver?
Oh, no. Did we lose him?
I don't know. I think we did. It says he's there. Maybe he got upset. Maybe I scared him away. I didn't mean to. But I think what Oliver was trying to say is we need to look out for each other. Because this business will chew you up and spit you out. So.
I agree. And I think it can be... I think singers are, you know, they tend to... There's a lot of loneliness going around.
Yes.
And you have to be really self-reliant, and if you don't get enough encouragement and so forth, and who needs that more than singers, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Well, I'm sorry, I feel bad we lost Oliver.
Yeah, Oliver got disconnected. I heard
that. Busy. Well, that was...
A little sploosh.
Guess who died? There it is. Well, you know, and one final note. Placido Domingo is going to be on The Simpsons September 30th.
On the lighter side.
Yeah, that's it. But anyway, I want to thank Brian for coming on today. First of all, I got to plug my shit. Oliver, you back?
I'm back on the show.
I'm sorry,
yes.
We lost you.
I know, the damn internet.
Go ahead. Did you have a quick thing to say before we
No,
sign
just
out?
just to finish what I was saying. That, you know, we're all in this business because we love music and we know that music improves our lives, and we want to, you know, share the joy that we have of doing this with our audience and with our colleagues. And that is really the point of this. And so, you know, we have to take care of each other too. And there are many opportunities for us to be catty and to stab each other in the back and whatnot. But ultimately, we should be grateful to know each other and to know that we all have the same goals, you know, and trying to achieve this.
Yeah, very well said, Oliver. Thank you. All right, that was another edition of Opera Now, episode 26. Check out our website, operanow.blogspot.com. If you have any comments or questions, feel free
to be sure to check out the nice footage of Roberto Alagna.
Yeah, check out our hot softcore porn Alagna clip from YouTube. Or email us at operanow@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail, 206-424-3617. And I'm telling you right now, if you're listening to the show, email me. Leave me a message. I need it now. I need to know you're out there. And tell your friends. Spread the word to everybody you know. More than ever, spread the word. We're on Facebook. Go to look for my name, Michael Rice, on Facebook. You'll see our Opera Now page. And you'll see we've got a group up there as well. Feel free to join that and spread the word that way. I want to thank my man B-Mac.
Again, thanks for having me.
And Oka, the OC. And Ethan never showed up. Ethan is dead to me. He is banned from future shows. So thanks for listening to Opera Now. I am your host, Michael Rice. So long, jerks.
I really do hope that Rachel Lovers or her friends call us. And
I do hope so, yeah.
We should get her on the panel as a recent transport from IU to the big city.
Yeah, to New York. That was great.
She'll be able to impart insights that most of us can only...
Oh, God, that was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. It was like it was something from
for
The Onion.
Indiana University, that's just crazy.
It was like it was in The Onion or something. Or National Lampoon.
Oh, I love it. Brian?
Yo.
Oliver? We've lost Oliver again.
Right. He just logged off again.
So much for the after show.
I got to call in a night anyway.
All right. What a disaster.
No, it's fine.
Hey, everybody. This is a special interview segment of Opera Now, today's episode. In light, this episode we're going to be talking a lot, and have been, of course, about the passing of Beverly Sills. And a few days ago, I received an email from my mother. And first of all, I want to say, you know, everybody has talked about Beverly Sills, that she was, you know, America's soprano. She was a great performer and a great singer, but people loved her, and, you know, the reason Johnny Carson and Merv kept bringing her back on TV is because she was a great guest, because she was a down-to-earth, real, genuine person who could talk about things other than opera and that people could, you know, appreciate, which is not the case all the time nowadays for whatever reason. But as you know, when she passed away a few days ago, my mother sent me an email saying that my father had a note from Beverly Sills, a personal note. So I thought that I'd take a few minutes to interview them, and we can explain the whole situation behind that and kind of get their impressions of her, because they've not only got a note from her, they've also met her and had dinner with her. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome, for the first time ever, the real people behind the origin of Opera Now, my parents, Tom and June Rice.
It's not our fault, is it, June?
Well,
you're the ones to blame for me foisting this crap upon people week after week. So thanks for coming on the show, guys.
Well, it's nice to be here.
You're welcome.
So, give us the skinny. You guys have personal dealings with Beverly Sills. Can you explain a little bit about it?
Sure, let me start. For many years, almost 18 years, I worked for Reader's Digest. And as some of you may or may not know, the Digest, particularly the founders of the Digest, DeWitt and Lila Wallace, were great supporters of Lincoln Center and the opera specifically. And I worked in the advertising division and back through the 70s and 80s, and was in charge of the New York office. And when I moved from Chicago to take over the New York office, I had a large entertainment budget. Most of the time, we took our clients and advertising agencies out to play golf, sometimes to the theater. But when I discovered that we had the opportunity to take advantage of the Wallace's generosity to Lincoln Center and have special dinners, I immediately picked up on that. And I thought, what better way to entertain, you know, some of the leading figures in advertising in New York City and in the clients who spent those advertising dollars in the Reader's Digest, than to give them an opportunity to go to New York City Opera or the Metropolitan Opera and have special treatment. So we set up a dinner one year at the Green Room in the New York City Opera when Beverly Sills was the general director. And we had about 24 guests. June and I were the host and hostess, and Beverly Sills joined us for dinner. And when I say she joined us for dinner, she joined us the way somebody would join you if you had them over to your home as a friend. It was as if we were having it in Beverly Sills' own dining room. And she was very gracious. She told stories. She laughed. She engaged people. And for some of the people in the room, it was, you know, one of their earliest, if not their first, exposure to opera at all. And because they had the opportunity to do it in such a special way, they came to see their first performance. And but Beverly made them at ease and literally went from table to table and engaged them in conversation, and just made everybody feel like they were a guest in her own house. Would you agree, Jill?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I do remember her going from table to table like as if she were the hostess at a wedding, or, you know, she just was very, very warm and vivacious, and I remember her laugh. She truly earned the name Bubbles. She just was a very bubbly personality. I mean, she just really was very, very warm and gracious. and just really made everyone feel very at home and welcomed. And she was very down to earth too, which is something I took away from that. She was a very, she was a real neighborhood girl, a neighborhood gal, I should say.
Yeah, so we did that. We did that one year. It was a great success. And again, because I was an opera fan, I wanted to do it again. And we did it, I believe it was the following season. And again, we invited people and said that we would you know, have a special opportunity to have dinner with Beverly Sills. And please come as our guests. And when we got to the green room that particular night, one of the administrators at the Opera House told us that Beverly had come down with some kind of an illness, a flu bug or something, and she was going to be unable to attend. In her place was going to be the chairman of the board of Lincoln Center, whose name I forget now, Leonard Goldstein, Goldbaum. I can't remember it right now.
He was a god.
But it was. He wasn't quite as exciting. But he was very gracious.
So,
he was very.
You people have never been to an opera before?
Yeah.
Well, it's hard to fill Beverly Sills' shoes.
That's for sure.
She had very large feet, apparently. That's what they said.
But anyway, so it was a disappointment, to say the least. But
there was a saving grace at the end, though, wasn't there?
Well, we didn't know that. And, you know, about a week later, we get an envelope addressed to us, to our home address, not to the Reader's Digest. To our home address in Connecticut, and it was a note from Beverly, and a personal note. I'll read you just some of the highlights. It's addressed to Mr. and Mrs. Rice. It says, "Bugs will be bugs, and try as one may, sometimes it's hard to fend them off. Alas, the flu bug hit our family last week, felling both my husband and me. What made me feel even worse was having to miss being your hostess at Wednesday's dinner. Welcoming new friends to City Opera always gives me special pleasure, and I truly regret not being able to join you, especially when we had such an exciting performance to follow your dinner. I do hope you enjoyed the evening, however, and that you will come again next year. I promise to take plenty of vitamin C ahead of time. Sincerely, Beverly Sills," and that big Beverly Sills-like signature that if you've ever seen it, you'd recognize it immediately. So, you know, we had her in person, and she was gracious and charming, and in her absence, she still managed to somehow be gracious and charming. So it was a personal thing that, you know, really didn't have to be done, and really surprised us. But I think it was kind of, you know, what you would expect from Beverly if you really knew what her personality was like and how, and you know what a very nice person she really was.
Yeah.
I remember one line she had at the time we had dinner, when she was there, and I think it was for a performance of Norman. I think it was a soprano of Irish heritage who had was making her debut in Norma. If you can imagine, a tough role, for a debut for sure in New York. And she said, you know, after I leave you guys, and after the performance, I've got to hustle on over and join a bunch of drunken Irishmen at the Gingerbread Man across the street celebration.
No O'Neills. So, we're gonna be there now.
But it was, that's who Beverly was. And, you know, we certainly don't know her the way other people know her. But our little bitty touch with her 12, 13 years ago, whatever it was, you know, had a kind of a lasting impression on us. And everybody who was in that room that night of dinner has had a lasting impression of her as well.
Well, I think that's the whole point. That was part of her charm. I mean, whether you enjoyed her as a performer or not, you can't deny that there was something about her that captured people's attention, even people who weren't necessarily. And that's why Merv and Johnny and Joe Franklin used to have her on the show all the time.
Yeah.
Just to, you know, to BS and talk about whatever. It wasn't just they had somebody on and they would talk to them about, you know, questions about costumes and singing in foreign languages.
And that's what she did at our dinner, because most of the people that were in that room that we had dinner that night were not hardcore aficionados of the opera. You know, they may have been interested in it and they may have attended a few performances, but they certainly weren't on the inside and could carry on an entire evening's dinner's worth of conversation about about the opera, and yet, you know, Beverly made it a point to talk about things that were of interest to them, and didn't just talk about opera. So, you know, she's the kind of person where you'd like to have her over at every dinner party you ever had in your life.
You know, even my parents liked her, and they loved opera. And even though she was a mid-a-gon, they loved her.
Yeah.
And she was one of the few mid-a-gons that they liked.
But they did like Michael, didn't they?
They didn't
well?
Even care, I mean, for
they
me.
Did.
They liked you a little bit. A little bit, a little bit.
So. Well, it's, again, it's thanks for a lot for coming on today, guys.
Okay.
And it was just nice to hear, you know, somebody's personal. So somebody, you know, somebody who's not in the business and the fan and kind of the whole reason that she was as popular as she was.
But there's thousands of people like us who aren't in the business that, that have a touch of your business because of people like Beverly Sells.
Yeah. And I would like to tell you, I almost was a part of one of those green room dinners when I was working at City Opera, but I got sick. So, which is probably for the best because I would have maybe turned people away.
I hope you wrote a note then, apologizing for your absence.
I wrote several emails.
There you go.
But I think it went up into spam folders. So.
All right. We raised you right. Good job, Mark.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for coming on, guys.
Okay. Take care, pal.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.